Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, and my co-host Arsen Kashkashian joining me at a very special venue that has become a real wonderful place for us to do these live recordings. We're live at the Boulder Public Library Canyon Theatre with a full house because our author is so popular, and we're delighted to have him returning again to the book club. Arsen, who have we been reading this month?
We've been reading Peter Heller, and his new book is The Orchard. It was published as an e-book many years ago, but this is its debut really as a print book, so we're very excited about it. And it's a different kind of book for Peter. It's all the nature that you want, but instead of guns, you get Chinese poetry.
Well, we're delighted to have Peter return again. We've done many episodes of the book club with you. And as Arsen was saying, The Orchard is a different book, not just for the Chinese poetry, which we will get into, but for the protagonist. Because people who've read Peter's books might be used to the swashbuckling element. We've got rangers, we've got fishermen, we've got, you know, folks out in really rustic parts of the country. But here we have a story told by a six-year-old girl, and the same girl when she's a little bit older, but really at the heart of this is six-year-old Frith and her mom and their dog Bear, and they're living in the titular orchard. And so how did a six-year-old girl's voice come into your head? What was that all about?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank, it's so great to be with you guys again. It's like old home week, you know, I just love it. And thanks so much, Chris, for having me here at the library and us. So to your question, I was a little weird, right? I was writing along, you know, I start with the first line, I never plot, I never know who the characters are going to be. I came up as a poet, as you know, and I always much more interested in the music of the language. And so I start with the first few lines. I have to be enchanted by the language and the heft of the words and the tone. And then I write into it. And so as I was writing this, and I realized that I was writing sort of in the first person from point of view of a six-year-old girl, I started to get a little uncomfortable. Like I knew that she was not going to reach into her breast pocket for a tin of Copenhagen at any point. And I was felt a little unmoored by that. But as I went along, I mean, so she started to speak. And as she spoke, I was just beguiled. She was so full of beans, you know, such a whipper, such a spark plug, and so smart and funny. Way smarter than me, and I think that's the magic of fiction, is that you can have a character that's smarter than me. How does that work? So I just loved it. I really don't know how it happened, but I found as I was writing that it was not at all a stretch, which is kind of fun, yeah.
Well, it had me thinking of, you know, True Grit with Maddie. It had me thinking of Scout and To Kill a Mockingbird. Frith is her own character. She's not either one of those. But it did have me thinking along those terms. And those, and like those books, you just wanted to hear her voice. And her voice, you find out as you're reading the book that she's a grown woman and she's kind of recounting this incidences that happened in her childhood. And so talk about, so you found this voice, but talk about the setting. So you put her in the orchard. She's really there with her mother and the dog. And then maybe talk about a little bit about this other character, Rosie, because in the book you say, this is where the story really begins, when Rosie shows up. So talk about that setting and those main characters.
All right, so I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn Heights. And I want to tell the library story since we're here. Can I just tell a story?
Go for it.
All right. When I was 11, I was wandering around my little library in my little school in Brooklyn Heights, and I had a crush on the librarian. I have to tell this for Chris. And her name was Annie Bosworth, and she was English. And I would have married her that day for the way she said my name. She said, Pita, are you looking for something to read? And I was like, uh-huh. And she said, well, come here. And a great librarian, like a great bookseller, and a great teacher or parent who's followed your reading since you were little, as she had, knows what you're ready for. She took me over to the fiction shelf. She pulled up a slim little volume of books called In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway, and it's mostly Nick Adams stories up in Michigan. You got to picture a kid who did not want to be in the city already. I cracked it open. My heart fell out of my chest. It was like, I want to do that. I want to hop off a slow-moving freight with a rucksack and fish the Big Two-Hearted River and make cowboy coffee on an open fire, whatever that was, and catch those gorgeous fish. But mostly I want to write like this guy, because it's the first time that prose sort of came through my skin straight to my heart. And I also, so that was, you know, a big deal. And here I was in New York City, and I had all these cousins in Putney, Vermont. There's like a Heller on every hill in Putney, Vermont. There's even a Heller Road, which is, I'm very proud of. I want to steal a sign every time I go back. But I had been, you know, spent parts of summers there and weekends and Thanksgivings, and all my cousins, they cross-country skied to school, and so I begged my parents when I was 15 to send me to high school there at the Putney School. I went, and that was the first time that I remember weeping for love of a place. I remember I spent 3 years there cutting my own firewood for a cabin, spending a lot of time outside, taking runs through those orchards that sort of quilted the wooded hills. I absolutely was just immured. I absolutely loved this place. And I remember standing with my dad at a stone wall, and I was 18, I was about to leave and go to college. And I saw the brooks that I ran up with my best friend, and the orchards where we swam in the pond, that very pond that's in the book. I could see the wood lot and the sugar bush where we had made maple syrup, and I just started crying. And it wasn't because I was sad to leave, because I wasn't going that far away, but it was because I didn't know what to do with the love of a place. Like, you can't wrap your arms around it. You can't make out with it or write it a love letter, because it won't read it. But you can jump into the pond and jump into the brook, and you can run the trails, and you can smell it, and you can walk with a friend up the road, and you can sleep under the stars there. And that's where I really learned that. And that place that's in the book sort of twined itself in through my, the fibers of my, through my body, actually. And I can't get away from it, even though I moved west and I've been here, 35 years or whatever, and, love it. That place is always, is in me, and I keep returning it to it in my fiction, even when I don't mean to. And so I think a lot of the book is about, here's this young woman who's a legendary translator of Tang Dynasty poetry. She's escaping a terrible marriage, coming to southern Vermont, to this village, moving into a cabin without electricity and running water in a defunct orchard, and with her little 6-year-old daughter, and continuing to translate these beautiful, beautiful poems from 1,500 years before. And they've got their dog Bear, and they're very sort of self-sufficient, sort of. They're trying to make maple syrup, trying to pick apples, and make a go of it. And she's still translating, these beautiful, beautiful poems. And along comes Rosie, who's a soft sculptor who lives in the next town over, and is intrigued by these people. Who wouldn't be? Frith just wants to be Tarzan. Her mom dresses her in her only dress and pats her down, ties the bow and pats her down and says, look, you're going to go to your one day at school. I'm going to dress you like, you don't become Tarzan. And I think there was a line in the book where Frith says, that was a poor rhetorical feint, because there's nothing in the world I would rather be than Tarzan. She's that kind of kid. And so anyway, that's the place. It's a place that I know and love very much. And the characters just surprised the heck out of me. They showed up and there they were.
Well, you write about the place so beautifully and so poetically. And it's it is like this refuge, and it's a magical place that Frith continues to have this emotional connection to when she's a grown woman. And I thought there was a real fairy tale element to the book, this beautiful magical place. A stranger shows up one day at the door, you know, that's Rosie. There's a yellow house with a blue door. There's a gang of motorcycle heroin dealers up the road who are actually pretty cool, but, you know, maybe they're not part of the fairy tale element. But I really thought they had this magical quality, not just the place itself, but how you have the characters within that place, too.
That's so interesting. You know, I've never thought of that, but I was reading it over this morning, a bunch of the book, and I was struck by that, especially when they go to visit Rosie. So they live in this little cabin that's 17 by 26, I think. And Rosie lives in this beautiful old yellow farmhouse in a field that's full of Persian rugs and heartwood floors and French doors, and it's just gorgeous. And I thought that today as I was reading, I thought this is like a fairy tale when they show up. So, yeah, cool.
Okay, we're all agreed.
So I was, very early in the story, you say, Frith says how childhood memories are subject to constant revision. And that's where you start to becomes more conscious that it's the adult Frith who's kind of re-inhabiting her younger self to tell this story. And so I guess I'm interested in that. It's not just a six-year-old telling the story. It is a grown person from years later. And what does that distance give you as a writer? Like, why choose to do it that way, I guess? Why have that? And as the book goes on, Frith's contemporary story becomes a little more important. But in the beginning, it's barely there, you know? So right. Talk about that evolution a little bit.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, I don't you know, plot or plan. And so the book began with the mid-30s Frith, who's the, you know, great translator, with a chest. There's a blizzard outside. And she pulls this chest to her, and she sits for a minute, and she sort of girds herself and tells herself, open the chest. Why haven't I opened the chest? And then she says, it's because, you know, I am now pregnant, and I know it's going to be a daughter. And inside the chest are the Li Shui Tang Dynasty poems that my mother Haley translated, the whole book, 30 poems. And I think that my future daughter, my soon-to-be daughter, is going to want to know about her grandmother. But she's resistant to opening the chest because she knows that she will be seared by not just memory, nostalgia, maybe grief for her mother, but just sheer beauty. The searing experience of so much beauty that's so personal. But she opens it, and inside is a file folder, a manila folder, and it's full of these poems. And she's struck, and she says something interesting, which as I was writing it, I thought was very interesting. She said, I wonder if the 30 poems that she translated, she had 500 poems to pick from the work of Li Shui. I wonder if the 30 she picked were somehow significant in sort of tracking our lives together. I wonder if they were germane to our lives together, and that's why she picked them. I thought that was so interesting, and I wondered too as I wrote them. And as Haley began translating the poems, I discovered that they really were. You know, she was sort of choosing, Haley the mother was sort of choosing these poems in a way maybe to document in some way the emotional sense of their lives together, which I thought was so fascinating. And I loved it. I loved writing it. And you said, you know, about the distance, you know, and then Frith, the child, took over the narrative in a way, which was so cool too. But I think about that layering, you know, how one can tell a story, you know, two steps back or three steps back, and then how Li Shui came in from, you know, centuries before through Haley, through Frith, and then to me, and I wrote them down, and it was a crazy experience because those poems just flowed. I mean, it was almost like, I mean, I think whenever a writer, you know, an author says, you know, something was channeled, they're lying, you know, and they just say that so that young writers coming up will be intimidated, you know, because it's like magic, you know. I mean, a young writer, when they hear, you know, they channeled something, what are they going to do with that? It's bullshit. They're in flow, and they're in flow because they've done, you know, written 10,000 stories and thrown them out. But that flow was crazy, and it felt like channeling. Just saying.
So one, the passage we picked out for you to read kind of is directly on this. Like, so if you could read that passage, it's about the hawks, and you'll see how it starts mirroring the poetry and the real life experience kind of come together in this very beautiful passage. So we'll let you find it there.
Okay. She was pointing east and north, and I saw them in the transparent blue, two shadows, broad-winged hawks gyring in opposite but overlapping circles. One was higher than the other, and they circled and climbed on the currents of heated air, and then the higher hawk stooped, folded her wings and tucked and dove straight at a point of intersection with the other. Even from here, the geometry was breathtaking. And a split second before impacting, her wings spread, and she veered away and shot upward. And in the same instant, the other tipped over, wingtip pointing at the treetops and folded to and dropped and caught himself on suddenly spread wings. He swooped upward after her and beat the great wings in fast pursuit. Helped by the updraft, he passed her and went higher and wheeled and dove. And then it looked like they were grappling. Both plummeted together, maybe entangled, but they tore themselves apart well above the woods, and then one was fleeing and one in chase, all of it unfolding as they drifted north, probably pushed by the wind. Was it life and death or play? I couldn't tell. It looked to me like they were having fun. Are they playing, I said? I think so. Or maybe fighting? Or maybe that's a date, she said. Whoa. I know, love is funny. That's a fact, I said. And she's six. And then skipping ahead, Arson wanted me to read this. The next poem, unsurprisingly, is called Hawks. Haley would have dug through the 500 or so of Li Shui's poem to find one that mirrored our time together. That her selection sometimes charted so closely my own memories, should it surprise me? It does. I know we were close, that our hearts sometimes, as on the mountain, seemed to beat as one. But that she so often chose poems that spoke to my own most treasured recollections, it was as if she herself were speaking from that time and saying, "Pup, hey, do you remember that morning in early September when we saw the rough legs flying?" "Yes, Haley, I remember. All on my own." The poem, Hawks. This morning we walked in white fog through the rhododendron and bamboo, up and up the narrow trail. The thunder of the first cascade shook the forest and threw cold spray. And we climbed above it, and we could barely hear its music below. We stopped when we heard the temple bell toll across the valley, our favorite ledge. The mist faded in sunlight. You pointed. "Look, hawks," you said. There were two, wings outstretched, sliding westward, circling each other and climbing. They made no effort, grew smaller and smaller until we lost them against the western mountains.
That's Peter Heller reading the poem Hawks, which is featured in his latest novel, The Orchard. That's been the subject of the Radio Book Club this month, and we're live with Peter here at the Boulder Public Library. And so that is by the poet, that's a translation mm-hmm. by Haley of the 8th century Chinese poet Li Jue, but Li Jue doesn't exist, right? That's a fictitious poem?
Right.
So you're the poet.
Yeah, so this is where, so I gotta say, my proudest moment as a writer, I was reading The River in that little stone library in Crested Butte. And it was a packed house, it was an October night, you know, cold, windy with the stars, and it was really fun. And then afterwards, somebody asked, what are you working on now? And I just finished the manuscript of The Orchard. And so I described it. About a legendary translator of Tang Dynasty poetry and her daughter. So afterward at the signing, someone came up, a woman with long braided gray hair and silver earrings, and she said, I am a translator of Tang Dynasty poetry. And I teach at the University of Virginia, and that's what I do. And I was like, you know, pushing my jaw up, and I said, my God, I said, would you vet my manuscript and look at the poems? You know, these are, I wrote them, you know, they're supposed to be. She said, of course, I'd be glad to. So I sent them, and 2 weeks later I got an email, and she said, the poems are marvelous, they pass.
Wow.
And, you know, they're classical Tang Dynasty poems. I was just so proud.
So what is it about Tang Dynasty poetry that enthralls you so much? Because I know this is something that you're not just interested in for this book, that you really yeah. have a love for this poetry.
Right. Well, I experienced it the first time. Yeah, many of you have heard the story of my first assignment for Outside, and a guy died on the trip, and it was very, very traumatic. And we gathered by the river, and we sang Amazing Grace, and then I had a book of poems. I thought my first assignment for Outside, for a magazine, I would bring a book of poems from the place to get the heart of the place. And I had a book of Tang Dynasty poems. And I read one. And it was called When Will I Be Home? And it goes, when will I be home? I don't know. In the mountains, in the rainy night, the autumn lake is flooded. One day we will be back together again. We will sit in the candlelight by the west window, and I will tell you how I remembered you tonight on the stormy mountain. I was so struck by that poem. It was just so simple and so moving. Not even moving, but like a punch. And I took that book home, and I pulled the threads on it. It was a little anthology. It was called 100 More Poems from the Chinese by Kenneth Rexroth, who's a wonderful poet himself, translated. And I started reading the poets that were in there, and I just was completely enchanted. Like, I decided these were the original blues men and women. Like they could, in five lines, they could put you in a knee deep in a mountain creek with a mist tearing through the pines, and then break your heart. And they were so clear, so simple, so beautiful. And so, you know, I've read them ever since. You know, for the past 35 years, that's what's on my bed table. And I love them.
So some of the most touching scenes are Haley thinks that Frith is sleeping, and Frith is looking over the loft, and she's kind of watching Haley do her translations, and she's listening as Haley kind of works out the sound of these poems. But you talk about how Haley doesn't translate them directly from the Chinese, that they're kind of interpreted first, and then she's like putting the rhythm and the music and a further interpretation. So I was really surprised by that. I was really surprised that Haley wasn't taking them directly from the Chinese.
Right.
But can you?
Well, she didn't know the Chinese fluently enough to do that. And I told my French translator of all my fiction is Céline Leroy, and I was telling her about that, and she translated the book. It's much better in French even. she's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant writer, translator. She was horrified when she read that part. She said, that's not translation. must be direct, you know, from the language. And but what I have found in reading Tang Dynasty poetry is that the very best translations are by people like Kenneth Rexroth, who were poets themselves who did not know Chinese. W.S. Merwin has some of the most brilliant translations of Tang Dynasty poetry, and he didn't know Chinese. And I found that that's true throughout. The scholars that are real Chinese scholars may not have the poetic sensibility so much to render the poems as beautifully as I think they must be in the original. So I basically had Haley, the legendary translator, which Celine would take umbrage to, I had Haley translate them the way W.S. Merwin must have translated Li Bai, where she would assemble the character, get direct translations of the characters from a Chinese interpreter, get some notations of the context and historical usage from academics she knew, and then probably, I imagine she listened to them out loud on a cassette tape. They didn't have electricity in the cabin, so must have been a battery-powered cassette tape, so she'd get the rhythm. And then she rendered the poems as they went through her, and I thought that was really cool. I don't think that's not translating. What do you think?
It's like interpretation and channeling, yeah. And it's really finding the essence, yeah, of the poetry. That's what I took when I was reading it. But that's so interesting to hear what a translator actually feels about that. But this book is a devastatingly beautiful look at love, loss, and grief, especially as you get towards the end of it. And I'm just going to put a warning out there for those of you who have not read it yet. Maybe don't read it on a plane. Maybe give yourself some space. I sat outside and looked at a mountain for about half an hour. That really helped me because it's just beautiful and it touches your soul in a very special way. And so how did you as the writer write that? When it's devastating for the reader, how is it for you?
I spent the last 30 pages in tears. I just had tears. You know, I write in a coffee shop, and I had tears pooling on the little table. And I know people were thinking, that poor son of a bitch. You know, he's going through the worst divorce, or his dog died. But really what was happening was I was, you know, probably more moved than I've ever been by anything. and thrilled at the same time. I mean, that's the crazy thing about writing that is like when you're that moved and you're writing along and you're in that flow, it's so heart-wrenching and it's also thrilling to be that transported.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was such a beautiful book. And we've talked about this before, but one of my favorite parts of your books are often the quiet times between all the guns. And so, you know, this book, there's always, to say it's quiet is kind of a misnomer in a way, because you're kind of at the edge of your seat, but in a different way, I think, reading this book. But Frith says at some point, I don't think people pay enough attention to the momentous times in our lives when nothing happens. And then she goes on to say that's when you kind of recalibrate yourself. The recalibration of yourself happens. And so that idea that we need that space, and sometimes you need the space in a book or a movie. You know, I recently took my daughter to a movie, I don't want to say which one, which I thought was great, but she's like, I never had time to breathe. And I feel like in your books, that's always been important for you.
Yeah, because I'm in the coffee shop and I'm writing them. I'm listening to Oregon Rain and my headset. It's supposed to be rain on a cabin roof, and I think it's like some guy with a hose on a piece of tin. But it works. And and there I am writing away. And you know, those actions, you know, those scenes where people get caught up in stuff and they have to survive, and or in this book where, you know, the there was a sense of survival in this book. in a way, in a quieter way. But then, you know, I'm writing along and I need a break too. And what better way to take a break than to maybe sit on a porch with a cup of coffee, or in some of the books, you know, fish a little bit. I mean, it's sort of like, I just thought of it, the image of like hanging a little sign on the coffee shop table that says gone fishing, you know, and writing away. But yeah, no, I need the break too. And it's wonderful for me just to, you know, in the middle of some of these very emotional scenes and books to step back and just be contemplative and maybe let the landscape take over for a little while.
I found the poetry gave that space as well, because, and you have the poems, you know, woven throughout the book, and it really helped that emotional journey. So I love that. And so as we're wrapping up the radio portion of the show, I think there's another poem that we're going to get you to read.
So this is the last poem, and it's called Winter Brook. When I climb above the brook, flying from purple cliffs, through the wind in pines, the lonely bell, and cross the creek and climb into the steaming mists and past them, and hear the geese descending in clouds, when I find myself humming, sail returning from distant shore, and feel the cold breath of the snows in the pass, then I will stop before going over and turn, and I will raise this empty wooden cup to you, my dearest companion. How many cups of spring water have we shared? How many cups of wine? Tonight, I will be so far away. We will not light the candles together. Tomorrow, only the sky and the mountains will be between us.
That's Peter Heller reading from The Orchard, his latest book. It's been what we've been reading as part of the Radio Book Club. And we're just so delighted to have Peter here. And we're live at the Boulder Public Library. And as we say goodbye to our radio audience, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast, because there's another episode coming where we're going to have questions from the audience. But in the meantime, Peter Heller, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. It's a love being here with you.
And as we do at the end of every episode, we announce what we're reading for the next month. So, Arson, what's the next pick?
We're going to read Second Chance Cinema by Thea Weiss. It's a novel, and it's a young couple, and they discover a hidden theater in their neighborhood, and they go into it, and what's on the screen is the story of their lives.
Ooh, okay. So excited for that. As always, subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes of the Radio Book Club. But live from the Boulder Public Library, I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host, Arson Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks, Arson.
Thank you, Maeve.